Well, good morning, everyone. Lovely to see you on another bright, sunny morning here. I hope you all have a chance to get outdoors later this afternoon. And maybe you'll see some snowdrops or some crocuses poking through the ground, which is always an uplifting sight. So, today I am going to share with you a Zen expression that I was quite taken by recently. It is, in Japanese, Ichiza Nigyo Sanshin. And Michael has kindly provided us with a visual. So this will help me explain it to you. You see one, two, three, ich, ni, san in Japanese. And so this expression means one, ichi-za, one seat. This is the, can you see it? Yeah. Za is the za of zazen, sitting meditations, zafu, sitting cushion, and zabutan, sitting padded mat. So one seat, which is our zazen practice. Nigyo. Gyo means most conventionally just the verb to go, go on a trip. Tabi ni iku. But gyo also means spiritual practice. So zazen is gyo, chanting is gyo, doing ceremonies is gyo, cooking practice, tenzo practice, you could also say, is gyo. So gyo is practice, right? And then san shin, three. Shin is heart, both heart and mind, in as you know, in Asian cultures, which I think is such a wonderful way of embodying our practice, right? Heart and mind as one. So, one seat, two practices, three heart, mind. There it is. So I'm going to come back to this triad, but first, I really would like to honor and give credit to Shohaku Okumura Roshi, who was Michael's and my first Soto Zen teacher in Japan many long years ago, before he was even known, really, in the West, and author of this book, Living by Vow. Highly recommended, which we are reading in our Sangha Leaders study group we just started, with a chapter on vow, which is where this saying appears. And in the book, he offers his commentary on many of the fundamental chants we do in our Soto Zen practice, the Heart Sutra, Merging of Difference and Unity, the Meal Chant, the Four Bodhisattva Vows, the Refuges. He gives beautiful commentary on all those sort of fundamentals, so maybe we'll touch more in the coming weeks and months on some of what we're studying with him. So the bodhisattva vows, which we chant at the end of a Dharma talk, we will today, and also in our monthly bodhisattva precept ceremony. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. or in some translations, which I also like, I vow to embody it. I credit Okumura Roshi, or in those days we just called him Shohaku-san. He wasn't a Roshi yet. I credit him not only with introducing me to Dogen's Soto Zen way of practicing, but giving me an unshakable foundation in it. Now, that's not to say that my practice is unshakable, or that I, Kate, am unshakable, but Zazen is. Or maybe it's not so much unshakable, but so deep and firmly rooted that no matter how hard it is shaken, nothing can uproot it. As I've said before, you know, those of you who may have seen them in or in photographs, there's bamboo forests in Asia where the trunks are big. These are big bamboos. And as I've said other times, they are said to be the safest place to be in an earthquake because those roots are so deep and tough and intertwined. So that's how I think of our Zazen practice, supporting us in that way. Because, of course, we are shaken, sometimes really hard in life. And Shohaku-san didn't convey that to us with a lot of elaborate Dharma talks. But through reading and commenting on Dogen, and sitting long, long hours of Zazen, we practiced in Uchiyama Roshi, his teacher, Uchiyama Roshi style, which is during Sesshin, you sit for 50-minute periods, 10-minute Kinhin periods, starting really early and going really late, and no Dharma talks, no Doksan, no frills, just a short morning service. So we were really grateful for our hour of weeding the garden after lunch. But there was something just profoundly liberating about that simple practice. Ichiza, one seat. Dogen certainly considered Zazen the core and an all-encompassing practice of the Buddha way. In Dogen's earliest writing on Zazen, Fukan Zazengi, which we sometimes chant, and we chant in Sesshin, Dogen tells us to cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech, even though we blah, 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 we talk about Zazen a lot, but to let that go. To learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away and your original face will be manifest. If you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. So for me, beginning practice with those words, you know, almost, I guess next year it'll be 40 years ago, all I had to do was just sit, stay in place, pay attention, and manifest my life from moment to moment, just as it is. That odd word, suchness or thusness, just as it is, life just as it is. So simple, and yet so immensely difficult, or beyond easy and difficult. So since I'm appreciating Shohaku-san today, let me read you a part of his commentary on Dogen's famous words to study the self, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, from Genjo Koan. This is Shohaku's commentary. When we study ourselves as the Buddha way, we find that there is no such self that is separate from others. The self is connected with all beings. We see that the self does not really exist. It's like a dream, a phantom, a bubble, a shadow, a drop of dew, or a flash of lightning, as the Diamond Sutra says. The self is in its self-being empty. So we need to forget the self. Even the self that is studying the Buddha way should be forgotten. The self forgets the self in studying the self. This is what we do in our Zazen by opening the hand of thought. That's that beautiful expression from Uchiyama Roshi, opening the hand of thought. We let go of whatever thoughts, feelings, or emotions come up from ourselves in Zazen. Letting go is complete negation of everything coming up from egocentric karmic self. We let go not only of selfish ideas, but also of our understanding of the Dharma. Just sitting, shikantaza, is the complete negation of the self, and at the same time, in letting go, everything is accepted. Nothing is negated. Everything is just as it is. Letting go of thought is not killing the thought. Thoughts are coming up moment by moment, but we just let go. Thoughts are there, but in our Zazen, we don't think. We just sit. Within just sitting, everything is just as it is. Nothing is negated and nothing is affirmed. This just sitting is the prajna, the wisdom, which sees emptiness without separation of subject and object. Zazen is not a kind of contemplation as a method through which I, the subject, can see emptiness as object. Practice of just sitting is itself prajna. This is why Dogen Zenji said, sitting is itself Buddha Dharma. Sitting is itself the true form of the self. So when I read or listen to Shohaku-san's words or Uchiyama Roshi's words, even though Uchiyama Roshi died a long time ago, we never met him, it just feels like they're channeling Dogen straight into me. So I hope you feel that way too. I think from these passages, and more, even more important, from your own experience of practice, you can begin to feel how the great Japanese Rinzai Zen master Hakuin Zenji says in his Song of Zazen, which we also chant sometimes, devotion, repentance, training, the many paramitas, all have their source in Zazen. Now, for those who might be new to practice, I'm just going to remind you all that the traditional paramitas, sometimes called perfections, but really they're practices. They're qualities we cultivate, and they are generosity, morality, patience, energy, concentration, and wisdom. And we've practiced and studied with them a lot over the years. But we always must remember they are deeply rooted in the practice and realization of Zazen. One seat, Ichiza. Your zafu, or bench, or chair, wherever you practice Zazen, at home, or at work, in a zendo, that is your Buddha seat. So please honor it. So it is this place, this single seat, Ichiza, from which Nigyo, the two practices, vow and repentance arise. And the one seat supports the practice of the two practices. So this is why in our tradition, we want people to have a few years of steady Zazen practice before taking up the study and practice of the precepts and formally receiving the precepts in the Jukai ceremony. So, two practices, vow and repentance. Those words can easily be tangled up with concepts from Christianity, Judaism, or Islam. The bodhisattva vows are notoriously impossible. And often people will say they're reluctant to approach Jukai, the Jukai ceremony, because it's so obvious that they will be unable to save all beings, end all delusions, enter all Dharma gates, or fully realize the Buddha way. What, me? Let alone keep all those precepts. But that hesitation, that contraction, comes from our conditioned, narrow view of I, me, and mine. Thinking that I am vowing to do all those things. I really like sometimes when I chant the Bodhisattva vows to either feel or say we, rather than just I, because that is actually maybe a little more accurate. So let me share some passages from Shohaku-san's chapter on the Bodhisattva vows. He says, as a bodhisattva, we can never say, I have achieved all vows. We cannot be proud of our achievements because in comparison with the infinite, anything we achieve is insignificant. Each of us has different capabilities, of course. If we cannot do very much, we practice just a little. There is no reason for us to feel small or say we're sorry. We just try to be right there, right here, with this body and mind and move forward one step or just half a step. This is our practice in a concrete sense. A life led by vow is a life animated or inspired by vow, not one that is watched, scolded, or consoled by vow. That passage really struck me. I want everybody who prepares for Jukai to really take that in. A life led by vow is animated or inspired by vow, not watched or scolded or consoled by vow. You know, so the vows are not something that we beat ourselves over the head with or punish ourselves when we slip up, which we do every day, right? And a vow should not be made by our intellect or an emotional impulse. It should come from the deepest part of us. This is Shohaku-san again. To vow to save all beings doesn't mean that we believe that we have the power to help all those who are in trouble. Imagining that were so would be truly quite arrogant. To save all beings means to be one with all beings. We cannot become one with others by means of our individual efforts, but we can wake up to the reality that from the beginning we are one with all beings. That is why we study the obstacles that prevent us from seeing this reality. This is how we become free from delusion. Yeah, so part of our practice of vows is seeing what gets in the way of our clear seeing. And that's another whole talk about the obstacles, but the obstacles are our greed, our aversion, our agitation, our sluggishness, and our doubt. Big one, doubt. So we bring our awareness to them. We notice when those obstacles are clouding our view and thus our speech and our actions. So this brings us to the second practice of the Nigyo, repentance, and why it is the companion hand in hand with vow. But again, the very word repentance can pose a bit of an obstacle depending on our associations. It can conjure up the language of sin and evil, so evocative of childhood encounters with religion, which for many of us have caused untold pain and confusion. Whether or not we've ever experienced anything like the Catholic ritual of confession, we've all learned guilt along the way, or many of us have learned guilt along the way. So take a few moments just to think back to a time in childhood when you first got the sense that you were bad. Not just that what you'd done, that you'd done something bad, but that you were bad. And do you remember how in your little child's heart you resisted that? Children go, but wait, no, I'm not bad, right? Children know that they're not bad, but over time, you get convinced that maybe you really are, right? So count yourself fortunate if you have never felt that way, because many of us have. And when we feel that way as a child, we feel that we've been banished from our parents or whoever holds that power over us, that we've been banished from their hearts and possibly by extension from God's heart, if we learn that. And that feeling of badness is unbearable. We yearn for absolution, for relief of being, or to the relief of being released from that banishment. So this can go several ways in children and in adults. We may become so eager to confess that we sometimes confess our guilt even when we're innocent, right? Just so we can get that absolution, that acceptance back. Or we may be so fearful of punishment that we don't dare to confess. You know, maybe this is why some people really have a hard time making an effective apology. Because to make an effective apology, you have to admit what harm you've done. And that can, it's really, really hard for some people. It's kind of obliterating to take that in. It becomes literally inadmissible to have done harm. And then the possibility is that we're so convinced that we're bad and that's what is expected of us that we just give up and say, well, why bother trying to be good? I'll just be bad because that's who I am, that's what I am. And others try eternally to convince themselves and others that they are truly good, good enough to be loved and accepted. So all these variations play out in our relationships and in our spiritual practice. So no wonder we're a little shy of repentance as a practice. But this practice of repentance is quite different from all that. We have a verse that we chant, a verse of repentance that we chant before, any time before we recite the Bodhisattva precepts. In a sense, it kind of sweeps the way clear for renewing our vows. And the verse, of, as you know, most of you, is all my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born from body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. And that's another one. Sometimes I like to chant all our ancient twisted karma, we now fully avow. So I'm doing it together with everybody. This verse asks us to see the deep, tangled roots of our karmic lives. You know, going back generations, going back millennia, really. Going back to our pre-human nervous system, even, right? Goes back really far. Our karmic lives. The verse asks us to acknowledge the three poisons of greed, hate, and delusion, that lead us to do harm, and to acknowledge body, speech, and mind, the means by which we do harm. And then we fully, openly voice this awareness, to avow. I quite like that word. It just means to speak openly, right? And to be witnessed. That's part of the practice, is to be witnessed by each other. So in doing that, we let go of both self-recrimination and blaming others for our inevitable shortcomings. We see our human weakness and delusion as part of the human condition. And we see that with wisdom and compassion, so that we can then renew and affirm our vows. So this practice of repentance is what allows us to work with our human imperfection, to apply patience, persistence, and compassion. And when we make repentance a moment-to-moment mindfulness practice, it actually becomes quite transformational. We can see ourselves and our actions and our thoughts in each moment, just as we are, with scrupulous honesty. Releasing, forgiving, we are free in the next moment to speak and act with as much skill and wisdom and compassion as we can. The many times that we fail, as Norman Fisher says, mature and temper us like strong pottery. So this repentance as an everyday mindfulness practice lets us catch and release, over and over and over. I think it's a practice that's closely related to forgiveness practice. Maybe it's the same thing. Maybe this is what forgiveness is in our practice. Releasing after we fully avow our ancient twisted karma. So this practice of repentance, from a Dharma perspective, is guilt-free. It's not about guilt. It's about seeing deeply. We see life, what is, as clearly as we can in each moment, and then we take full responsibility for how we respond to the next moment. So practicing with repentance in this way is intense, deep inner work. And it's also all about relationship, right? Our intricate connections with each other. So repentance is also a Sangha practice, a family practice, workplace practice. Imagine if we could not come to the end of the day without avowing, right? Without saying to our partner, oh, you know, I think when you were trying to tell me how worried you were about your mom, I was just really inattentive and distracted. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. Or, remember how impatient and snappish I was with you this morning? I didn't say it at the time, but I noticed and I'm sorry about that. You know, just simple. And you know, the closer to the time we can get is better, but if we didn't get it at the time, before the end of the day, we can pause and fully avow. Makes a big difference. So one more thing about repentance, is there are two kinds of repentance. Repentance in Japanese is sangye, and there's jisangye and risangye. And jisangye, we know about the two aspects of life and reality, the relative and the absolute. So ji is the relative and ni is the absolute. So ji sangye, relative repentance, is the stuff of the everyday relative world. That basically is what we've just been talking about. You know, the relative world in which we have to use our best discernment to make decisions and take the best course of action we can based on the circumstances and information we have before us, which is pretty much always incomplete, right? So we don't know always. We can't know for sure that the best outcome is going to come from our best intentions, right? That's the world of the relative, and that's where we have to exercise the practice of relative repentance. Often, even our best intentions are contaminated, grossly or subtly, by greed, aversion, and ignorance, right? We're not always in control of the outcome. We rarely are fully in control of the outcome. So this is a dynamic practice that we're talking about here. But then there's absolute repentance, Nisange, which takes us back to our one seat, back to our place of Zazen practice, where we sit with a mind that is so spacious that it includes and goes beyond good and bad and everything in between and the burden of the discriminating mind. So that's where we relax our grip, we open the hand of thought and let go. And this is where we renew, the place from which we renew our bodhisattva vows and continue our practice endlessly, together with and for all beings. And this is the place then, arising from the one seat and the two practices, that the three kinds of heart and mind can be actualized and expressed. So they are, here's another visual, Kishin, Noshin, and Daishin. So here, one big heart kind of references all three. So Kishin is joyful mind, Noshin is, No is old, but often it's Dobashin, old woman mind. So Kishin is joyful mind, Noshin or Dobashin is sometimes translated as parental mind, but I like grandmother mind. Or grandparent mind, grandma and grandpa mind, we can call it. And then Daishin, Dai just means large, but it means a spacious, magnanimous. These three, just to mention, Shohaku Okumura's Zen Center in Bloomington, Indiana, is called Sanshin Zen Community, referencing those three. And clearly this is really important to Shohaku because of his link back. He one of the first books that he was involved in translating Dogen was Tenzo Kyokun, Dogen's Instructions to the Cook. And that was the first Zen book I ever read. Not Zen My Beginner's Mind, but Instructions to the Cook. So it's quite a beloved text to me, and we've studied it many times over the years. But Dogen believed that the position of a Zen cook required a high level of attention to detail, great care and respect for the raw materials of the meals, the utensils of the kitchen, and those who would eat the food. So these were the three qualities of mind that Dogen felt were essential to the cook. Michael did a talk on joyful mind sometime last year. Time is a little blurry. I don't remember exactly when it was. So I won't say too much, other than that joyful mind is characterized by a sense of gratitude and lightness, appreciation for this human life on earth. Just being alive. And a willingness to meet each day afresh with whatever gifts and challenges it presents. Joyful mind is creative and connected and able to collaborate with vegetables and tools and human helpers in the kitchen and beyond. So as I said, Roshin means literally old mind, or we'll say grandpa and grandma mind. And maybe that's because grandparents not always, but often, grandparents have acquired a kind of wisdom and softening that comes with age and without the pressures and stresses and confusions and immaturities of parenthood. So sometimes grandparents are better able to offer unconditional love and acceptance to their grandchildren than they were to their own children. Dogen says, when you handle rice, water, or anything else, you must have the affectionate and caring concern of a parent raising a child. You know, so instead of banging and slamming around the kitchen, to really move and handle things with care. And then the third, Daishin, great or magnanimous mind, Dogen says, is like a mountain, stable and impartial. Exemplifying the ocean, it is tolerant and views everything from the broadest perspective without prejudice and refusing to take sides. When carrying something that weighs an ounce, do not think of it as light, and likewise, when you have to carry 50 pounds, do not think of it as heavy. Do not get carried away by the sounds of spring, nor become heavy-hearted when seeing the colors of fall. Yeah, so Daishin is this great or magnanimous mind, is the mind of equanimity and poise. Good thing to have in the kitchen, too. And beyond, in the workplace, in family life, and Sangha life. So these three minds of the Zen cook, we can cultivate and extend into every aspect of our lives. And I felt, you know, when we studied this chapter and discussed it within our Sangha leaders group, I thought, oh, so simple, these, you know, one seat, two practices, three heart minds. But somehow it just really, really brought it all home for me at a time when so many of us, you know, after 2 years of pandemic life and constriction and fatigue, and now as we are emerging, you know, there's some shakiness and uncertainty in that emerging for many of us, I think. And so somehow these three, you know, triads are nice. The triads are stable. They hold us up when we are shaky. So I wanted to share them with you. There's another Zen saying. There's lots of Zen sayings, so many, that Shohaku introduces in his book, Living by Vow, that goes, Gansho no Bosatsu, Gosho no Bompu. I don't have a visual for that one, but what it means is, a bodhisattva is led by vow, an ordinary person is led by karma. And some of you will remember Michael talking about this one sometime last year, maybe. Most of us are pushed and pulled, led by our karmic lives. We are blown about by the eight worldly winds, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. You know, we're always leaning towards one and away from the other, blown around. But when we just sit on our Buddha seat, and I don't mean just our zafu, but our bicycle, our office chair, or sitting on a log at the beach, and our self-clinging drops away, then we just meet the 10,000 things as they come forward to meet us. And yes, we slip back into Gosho no Bompu, the ordinary person being led by karma, over and over and over again. So our practice is just to notice the slippage, right? Notice the slippage. And renew. Renew our attention to live a life in alignment with our vows, led by vows. Catch and release. And then we're bodhisattvas. You know, we're really bodhisattvas all along, but we just slip. And this actually really is our bodhisattva practice here on earth. Grounded, in our one Buddha seat, supported by the two practices of vow and repentance, which frees us to express our joyful mind, our grandpa and grandma mind, and our spacious, magnanimous mind. Ichiza Nigyo Sanshin. So, thank you everyone for coming to practice this morning and for your kind attention. Let us chant the Bodhisattva vows together. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.